Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. We're glad you've taken time to join us for another edition of Midrats. We have our world-famous, ever-popular Melee format today. No guest, just me, you, and we've got Paul in the chat room. And if you're with us live, I'd like to extend the invitation for you, as always, to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. And if you have some observations you want to share or a question or issue you would like for us to grab hold of over the course of the next hour, that is the perfect place to do that. And we look forward to seeing you there. Eagle One, good afternoon.
Hey, Sal. How's your day?
It's better than I deserve. We've got a glorious day here in the free state of Florida. I got no complaints. I'm hanging out in my T-shirts and shorts is my natural state. And they are cargo shorts, so the haters can continue to hate. But they're very handy. I get to store things in them. You and I kind of solved all the world's problems in the pre-show. I don't know if we need to talk about anything else, but I guess we could share our brilliant ideas with everybody else.
Well, we got Chris and Paul. You know, they're going to listen to us, so I guess we can start with some hot topic.
Hey, yeah, Chris Raleigh, it's great to see you again. And just a reminder to everybody, Elon Musk contracted some special forces people and extracted Chris Raleigh from that deep hole that he had been hiding in over on X or / Twitter. So if you don't already, go find Chris over there. He's always a good person to keep track of, and it's glad to have him back on board today. I think because it's been the item above the fold all week, I guess we really should start off with which really was amazing video, the dropping of the Francis Scott Key Bridge out of Baltimore, making everybody in the Beltway's commute just that much more interesting.
Yeah, it's something that shouldn't happen, does happen. You know, I love the conspiracy theories. It's space aliens. It's some kind of computer hacking job. You know, it's never as simple. Nobody ever applies Occam's razor. Oh, gee, we had a breakdown. Our engine quit running, and that powered everything else, and so we ran into a bridge.
Yeah, it kind of goes in that category that some people need to stop reading science fiction and military fiction and maybe pick up a history book or read current affairs or stuff. Some of those things were straight out of some of the books that you can read if you want to. But when you have, especially all ships have been this way from the dawn of time, but especially modern merchant ships and military ships, they're very complicated. They're real tightly designed ships that work great, work very efficiently. But when they have a breakdown, as all mechanical things made by humans will eventually break down, you just hope that they're breaking down in a place where you have some margin of error. I think I think it was in New York, we had a large merchant ship have a similar problem in the general wedge of problems that the ship in Baltimore did, but she had time to drop anchor and hang out in a safe place. But even if you're only going, I think they're going 8 knots, that's pretty fast in a tight channel. Going through a bridge like that, it's just one of those cases that you have to, if you're in one of these places where there's no margin of error, how good are your contingency plans? And this was one of those situations that I'm sure people talked about, maybe even planned. We'll find out when the final record is written on this. But it was just force equals mass times acceleration. It's and it happened. It's a warning, I think, to all of our major ports is to look at your procedures and your requirements. When are tugs optional? When are they required? How many should a ship have? What's your contact look? You know, for us Navy guys, when was the last time you updated your op ref binder? That type of thing. So again, it's another warning for everybody that don't assume that the access you have is the access you'll always have. An act of nature or an act of man, either by accident or by intention, can change things. Luckily, we're a big nation. If you're worried about trade, I know there's localized economic issues. Baltimore, that poor city, last thing they needed was this. There are plenty of ports either side of the port of Baltimore. She's not really even a major port anymore. I read somewhere she's like 14th. I could be wrong, but she's somewhere in the teens. So it won't be that big of an impact writ large for our Navy, I mean our nation. But it's interesting to watch this procedure going down. And I feel like they should be, you know, paying us a couple of shekels a show. But again, there's a lot of things in their wheelhouse have been coming up. And I think Sal Marcogliano and John Conrad have, and I know John actually went there in person with a couple of folks we also know. And it's those are always good people to keep track of if you want a little bit of professional expertise, because that's definitely in their wheelhouse.
I think Murphy's Law is going to rear its ugly head. The whole point about Murphy's Law is you don't know exactly when, but it'll be at the worst possible moment. So, it's not too surprising that if you have a casualty and you're just getting underway, your ship's had a kind of a shaky history on some things, that it's going to happen fairly early, and it's going to, when things do happen, and you've got that much, as you already said, you've got that much mass moving at a speed, it's really hard to stop things. And I think a lot of the people who were looking at this, they didn't understand why the ship couldn't anchor. If you anchor at going that speed, you're just going to rip things loose. If you're going to go try and back all full, you're not talking about something you can stop on a dime. It's not a twin-screw destroyer with 250,000 shaft horsepower. It may have a lot of horsepower, but it's also got a lot of weight to try and stop the momentum, and it's just not going to work, turn on a dime. And the other thing is that people have been, I think, misapprehending how complicated it is to try and start the recovery on this. You've got water visibility that's terrible. There's a really good three-dimensional picture that I'll put a link up to in a minute that shows what the mess is on the floor underneath this bridge. So, they had to send divers down. They had to get pictures of the imagery. They had to get the cranes in place. They had to get, structural engineers in there to talk about the weight of the stuff that's sitting both on the ship. They didn't want to do anything that would cause further pollution. The ship was damaged. It's got some pretty good chunks taken out of it. It's got a big chunk of metal, a bunch of metal sitting on top of the containers. And we got all those containers on there, and then to further complicate things, there's a natural gas pipeline, I think, underneath the ship right now. So the ship is grounded. It's got some issues. They're beginning to move the containers off, but that's a really slow job. It's going to be one container at a time. I don't remember exactly how many containers are on this thing, but that's going to be a painful exercise to try and get enough containers off so they can get this thing, the ship floated. They have to get the metal off the bow, and they've got to then go down and try and retrieve the stuff that's on the bottom. All that being said, the Corps of Engineers has done a pretty good job saying, here's our timeline. By the end of April, we want to have a 35-foot depth channel, 280 feet wide, to allow some passage of shipping in and out of the port of Baltimore. And by the end of May, we would like to have our 50-foot channel, 700 feet wide, restored to allow pretty much all traffic. Now, that's, contingent on a lot of weather and other factors, but somebody has, you know, they've developed a plan. They have a group that this is the way it works under the National Incident Management System, that they have a group, you know, that is working together to sort all this out so that you don't have a bunch of lone wolves out running off, running around in all different directions. You've got a team being assembled between the Coast Guard and the Navy and the port authorities and the, you know, all the other people of interest in the area. They have a plan to get this thing restored. And it's going to, you know, it's not a job, unlike some people's expectations that, you know, well, yeah, the bridge dropping, we'll have it clear tomorrow. That's just not going to work. It's different than the ones where we've lost part of a bridge, a highway bridge, and they were able to slap something in place pretty quickly because you got water involved here. And that is and it's not crystal clear water, so you've got all kinds of complicating factors as a result of that. But I think they're doing a pretty good job on it. There is nothing to be said that it can't be done better, but there's also a lot to be said that it could be done much worse than what they've got. They've assembling the things they need to get it done, and I think that's really kind of the key issue at this point.
And I think it's also, you know, obviously, this doesn't apply for the individuals and their families who were died, the folks that were filling up some of the potholes on the river when it collapsed. But we've been really lucky in a lot of regards. You know, that we've all been going over bridges at rush hour with a big ship underneath. And I don't know about you, but I have to tell myself, quit looking at the ship and drive, because it's really neat to see that. But it was in the middle of the night, so it wasn't full of commuters or anybody like that. And the weather, hopefully it will hold. This isn't the time of the year where you're expecting one of those hurricanes to come screaming up the East Coast. We've got, you know, a few months till we need to worry about that. Hopefully all that will be resolved. And, all the things you outlined, they're actually underneath the ship. We're also lucky that none of that was ruptured. It could have been a lot worse. And it is an opportunity to, because you have these incident plans that you have on the shelf and you exercise them on a regular basis. You know, you talk about the whole of government approach. You have to have the Department of Transportation, Department of Defense, depending upon where you are, Department of Labor, and Environmental Protection, all got to work together to try to expedite and get things fixed and moving in the right direction in a safe way. And it is going to take time. But for those that have worked in emergency management incident response, I know that they're paying close attention to it because this is one of those opportunities that you have the theory and you have similar things that have happened in the past that you try to adjust your plans with. But there are smart people in hard jobs, important positions that are going to look at this in order to take some really good lessons away from this. So the next time we have something similar, not exactly like it, but similar, that have a similar set of challenges, their response will be better. I guess that the key is I've got confidence that they'll put together a good lessons. I'm confident that those people in ports, I know you know, some of those jobs and those individuals that perhaps even that they're going to look at and adjust their plans. I think that the tough follow through, and I don't know how you hold this accountable, is will the lessons learned be properly resourced from Congress and maybe even at the state level to make sure, hey, they were able to do X in Baltimore because they had ready access to Y and Z. We don't have ready access to Y and Z, or there nobody thought that we needed W. We should really make sure and get W. But to take those lessons learned and to apply them, many of them are going to require proper funding and resourcing from those that control the purse strings and also the approval or disapproval of the plans.
Yeah, and you run into people, you know, running around in circles going, we don't have somebody let us down. We don't have the giant cranes we used to have available. What happened to all that stuff? And I'll tell you what happened. That stuff aged. A lot of that equipment, equipment got old, and it requires maintenance, and you either decide at some point, well, it also required humans to maintain it, required humans to operate it. At some point, you make a decision, maybe it's a good decision or a bad decision, but you make a decision that it's cheaper for the country as a whole to, you know, let the salvage companies, the big salvage companies, bring in the stuff that they've got and let them deal with issues like this. Now, there's a lot of concern that we have some sea transport ships, I think, stuck behind where this thing is. You know, that's not fatal. It is an issue, but I'm not sure that if we had a huge crane, one of the big ones we used to have, sitting down in Charleston, that it would have been that much faster to get it up and get it organized and set up and placed and made things, you know, that much quicker to get this resolved. You still have the issues of surveying what work needs to be done. You've got to get experienced divers down there to take a good look, and they can't see anything. You're being directed by people up above who have, you know, side scan sonar or something that they're looking at to tell them where to go. And then you've got to figure out how big a chunk you can cut up of this bridge that's lying on the seafloor to get it up out of the way and not strain the cranes you do have. So I think that, you know, again, that it's easy to second guess the elimination of some of the equipment we had, and I certainly think we ought to have more, at least more salvage capability internally in the Navy. But we do have mud SEW units, the mobile diving and salvage units. You know, their work is not always as heavy as this. We do have in MSC some salvage tugs, but it's not like it used to be. But if you look at what happened after Pearl Harbor, the amount of effort that was put into getting those battleships turned around out of the muck and mire and you see the equipment they used to do that, it was a massive undertaking. Probably something, I don't think I've ever seen it quite like it when you really look at the pictures of what they were doing. So it's worth going back into history, taking a look at what it would really take, you know. And then we have examples recently. We had the Sky Lane Bridge down in Florida that got whacked. We have this car carrier that rolled over off Savannah, I think, you know, and the cruise ship off Italy. You know, these are big ships. They're big problems, and there is no fast solution to getting them back the way you want. But, you know, as fast as you can clear this channel, which they're saying within a month or two, or give them the benefit of the doubt, let's say 3 months from now, they're going to have a channel flowing through there. And then the second issue is rebuilding a bridge.
Yeah, you brought up a good point about, you know, a lot of the equipment aged out. You know, it doesn't last forever. It's not you can't, when things get over, depending upon what it is, you know, over 30 years, and especially over 50 years old, it's just you don't want it to get underway, or you don't want to use it because you know something's going to break real fast, and it could be more of a problem than it's there to fix. But I think part of it, and we've seen this, and we've talked about it a little bit, from the Bonhomme Richard when it burned over in San Diego, and you could even look at, you know, what we have at the Francis Scott Key Bridge, is we have been, we being the maritime sector in the U.S., we've been at peace for a long, long time, for decades. If you, in the sector of peace where people are shooting at you and blowing stuff up, you know, we had the USS Cole that was hit. We had the Samuel B. Roberts that got hit. You know, we have onesies and twosies here and there that you can handle with, you know, hey, we need a heavy lift ship because we have this frigate with a big hole in it that needs to go back from Bahrain to the East Coast to get fixed up. You can do that because that's a peacetime thing. But for the first time, I keep calling it the edge of living memory, but it's really becoming outside of living memory when you're talking about World War II. It's not just the equipment that ages out. It's the institutional memory that ages out. Your, quote, graybeards, unquote, that you see around here, they're, no offense, they're from Vietnam. And the Navy in Vietnam got shot at a little bit, but had nothing like their predecessors had, you know, their gray beards with the World War II experience. So you could have a group of people making decisions. None of them have that institutional memory of living through it. So we don't have enough fireboats, enough salvage. We don't have enough heavy lift cranes. If we are really facing what we think we are facing for the next couple of decades west of the international dateline, where if we get in a real fighting naval war, we're going to have lots of ships sunk, lots of ships significantly damaged that need to be repaired, hopefully in an expeditionary manner. And yes, we have a challenging budget situation, but I'd always thought that a lot of these assets, and we've talked about this before, I have a little bit of jealousy towards the Air Force and the Army, and to a lesser extent the Marine Corps, for this one reason, is they do a better job of recapturing the experience of their people who leave active duty and decide not to make the active duty career in the reserves, the National Guard, the Air Guard, et cetera, and so forth. The Navy, not so much. I mean, we have the Naval Reserve, but I think there's a lot of these things that we could have in the reserves if we could capitalize it a little better, that would be there for when we need them, if we are serious about contesting the waters against what is now the world's largest Navy west of the international dateline. I think we need to look harder at that, because we have a different situation here and in the 2020s than we've had pretty much in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's interesting that the experience of loading those ships onto those heavy lift things was done under, if not totally, but under the guidance of an officer named Captain Greg Gant. And Greg Gant is a reserve officer. He's an EDO. But he's the guy who supervised both the Samuel B. Roberts and the ship that got hit in Yemen, and getting them on the heavy lift ships. Now, here's a guy who's my age, maybe a little younger, but not much, and he's the guy who had that internal knowledge. Now, is there another person who has acquired heavy lift in the United States Navy Reserve or on active duty who's acquired that same kind of depth of experience? Are we going to have to bring Greg out of retirement and put him to work again if we have another one of these incidents? You know, I don't know the answer to that, and it's an interesting dilemma for us. I also question whether sometimes what we look at is these ships now are so much more complex than the ships in World War II, that if you get a major hit, and let's say on a DDG, is it possible to salvage it the way we used to salvage ships during World War II? Can you take it into some island and have a large floating dry dock there and say, okay, we can fix this right up? Because I'm not sure that, you know, I'm questioning whether or not somebody's made the decision. These things are so complex and so tough, we can't do what we used to do. We'd have to bring it back and reassemble it in some major shipyard in the U.S. Or maybe if we're lucky, if Korea is around or Japan is around at the time, we could take them there. But I'm interested in how much it costs when we had those two DDGs, the McCain and the, what was the other one? They hit merchant ships or what? Yeah, Fitzgerald. You know, I don't know how much it costs to restore those things, but it was not one of those things where we can rush this thing back to the yard and have it back out in the guns a-blazing in 6 weeks, because we could do the work off Guam in the Ulithi or the Truk Atoll or something. I mean, I'm wondering if somebody has gamed that out and said, we're just, these things are very, very important. We've done everything we can to protect them as well as we can, but once they're hit, they're pretty much toast, out of combat for months, if not years.
That would be a great topic for a congressional hearing. Engineering duty officers aren't known for their theatrical presence, but that would be a really good congressional oversight exercise, is to get that out in the open to discuss it, because that's really interesting. And we do have a data point from the Fitzgerald, the McCain, and the Cole about our Arleigh Burkes that were robustly built. And you might have a good point about, you know, a lot of those, if your ship's designed to take multiple 8-inch armor-piercing shells, they're probably pretty sturdy to repair, whereas our modern warships, even the Arleigh Burkes, are, by historical standards of the last 125 years, are pretty thin-skinned. Maybe there is a warping that makes it much more difficult to repair. Also, all the electrical issues. It's one thing when your electrical system is all copper wire, but our modern electrical systems and the integrated computers, when those things get fried, that's a real interesting exercise. It's not like you can just dewater a space, do a little bit of painting and spot welding and turn on the light and you're up and running again. It doesn't work the same way, but that would be a very, very interesting exercise. Of course, the follow-on question there is, okay, so what is our favorite triggering topic here? What is our shipyard repair capacity to be able to address that? Whether, you know, forget forward, because we don't have the equipment to do forward, but if we're fighting west of the international dateline, then we got to haul those things back to at least Hawaii or the West Coast. You're right. It would be wonderful if we could have access to South Korea or Japanese yards, but they're so close to the game. I hope that we're planning that because of either enemy action or political action, that we will not have access to those. And I don't think there's much capacity in Australia to cover that, which, because it's a relatively small nation of 22 million souls, I think it is, with not that huge of a shipyard repair capacity.
Yeah, I'm also looking at it. I mean, the Navy just came out with this, or somebody revealed this this chart of where our construction stuff stands. A lot of it is not the Navy's fault. You know, well, some of it is, a lot of it is Congress's fault because of this stupid continuing resolution stuff that goes on and the inability apparently to say, okay, we're going to do a 5-year program of building Constellation class frigates and here's the money to do that and we're not going to interrupt that for anything. So, but you get a ship like the Constellation. Here we find this concept of the ready design. All we had to do was put U.S. flag on it, and we're going to have great little ships. And then, what is it now? 85% of it, or 80% of those ships now is new Navy design because, and this is where I come into the question again about durability, because of the Navy, U.S. Navy's higher standard of components that would ensure its survivability. And you know, does that mean again that? The Italians and the French and the other folks involved in those things are just saying, well, yeah, they're mostly expendable, but we want them to go do X and X and X, and if we lose them, then we're not happy with it, but we can't do anything about that.
Here's where I have to find my center and do a little bit of meditation to control my rage. That you're right. They have completely flipped. It was originally supposed to be 85% commonality. Now it's 15% commonality. They completely, you know, they selected the Frem, and I mean, one reader got a little bit snippy in my comments, thinking I worked for Fincantieri or something. Again, I do not work for government. I do not work in the military industrial complex at all, full stop. Anyway, Was what I liked about the FREM program, and something that I started writing about literally in 2010, was we need a smaller combatant. LCS is not going to do it. We don't have time to do a new build. So what we needed to do was to contract build a successful existing class that for, and I think back then I said a run of 24 to 36 ships while we design our own ship to get it in the water, because that's the requirement. Everything is a compromise. Everything is a trade-off. And we already lost a generation with LCS, and no reason to rehack that, however entertaining it might be to drag it out of the GIMP box and beat it a bit. But we don't have time to fiddle around forgetting what is the supported and the supporting operation here. We need to get ships in the water. If we need to convert the FREM class to what the U.S. Navy says are requirements, if I was emperor, I would have said that's a great thing to do for flight too. But we don't have that luxury right now. We've got to get holes in the water. So 85% is the floor, not the ceiling. Put flight one in the water. Then you can do your adjustments for flight two. But we didn't do that for reasons that are best explained by other people who are paid a lot more money than I am. I think it's absolutely disgraceful. But what I found really interesting, because it ties into some macro issues about some institutional trouble with the truth, is I think it was back in January, the Navy reported that the Constellation would be a year late. 60 days later, they go, no, let's see. I'm actually looking at the chart. Constellation lead class, approximately 36 months, 3 years for you and me. So all of a sudden it slid to the right 24 months because of something that happened in the last 60 days. That is the story for those in the military press who want to dig into it. Why, who and why did we go from 12 months to 36 months inside of 60 days? That's just, I don't know, it's disgraceful is probably a kind word.
Yeah, I think we're still, you know, we've talked about so many things that involve shipbuilding that, you know, we don't have the shipyards. We don't have the skilled technicians. I'm really happy to see during these NCAA basketball games that, you know, this build submarine group, whoever they are, is out. It's probably submarine companies, the manufacturing outfits, but you know, they're out there looking for welders. They're out there saying this is a career. These are good jobs, and you're helping the country. I just don't understand Congress. I mean, I don't understand the cancellation. The group that McGrath was supposed to be on, we've talked about that. You know, why did they negate that? Whose finger is on the scale? Who's making things happen, making these things happen the way they do? And then not to have the nerve after you cancel, I mean, after you send out this sheet saying, here's the new delays, submarines delayed, frigates delayed, and so on. Then there's a big expo put on by the Navy League, I guess, and they were supposed to discuss shipbuilding. And 2 days before that was supposed to happen, the Navy says, nah, we're not going to do that, or whoever. I mean, they're not going to participate. Well, you know, that doesn't look good. If you're going to do anything, stand up and go, we screwed up, or, you know, here's our problem. Our problem is with Congress, and it's their fault. You know, I mean,
it is a huge lost opportunity.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is that, you know, when we're on X and we're going navalist, you know, more ships, la, 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 la. The Army guys and the Air Force guys are all over us saying, oh, no, you know, you guys have really screwed the pooch with your programs. I'm looking at the Army Crusader programs, all those other lost causes going, yeah, tell me about it. Why are you guys still getting a third of the money? I mean, we should be getting more money for the one asset everybody needs to have. And, you know, but we're locked into this jointness and stuff that, you know, the way we do things, it makes no sense. Somebody's going to have to go in there and clean house. And one of the things that I thought of, speaking of cleaning house, is when you look at Rickover, Rickover ran the Navy's nuclear power program, and pretty much nuclear power program for the country in many ways. So how long was he in that office? He was in that office forever. If you look at the Russian admirals who got their first, the fleet first built up, he was in office. Yeah, Gorshkov was there forever. Why don't we have a czar of shipbuilding who was there forever? Let him build a damn empire. But if he's good at his job, you know, we would, if he was in private technology, you had some guy who knew what he was doing, you wouldn't run him out after 2 or 3 years and say, oh, now it's your chance to become, you know, Southcom or something. Where's our czar for this? The Navy should have a czar for shipbuilding.
And
he's there for a long time.
And here's why that is so important. Accountability.